Amory and 107.5 FM W298DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Russian authorities say at least 133 people are dead after Friday's attack on a concert hall in Moscow. ABC's Patrick Reeval has the latest.
President Vladimir Putin has said Russia has detained all four of the suspected gunmen from the concert hall attack, as well as seven alleged accomplices. Putin said the men were arrested while trying to flee to Ukraine. ISIS has claimed responsibility, and the US says it shared intelligence with Moscow just weeks ago that the group was planning similar attacks.
President Biden today is expected to sign the $1.2 trillion government funding bill the Senate passed early this morning. It provides funding for the rest of the fiscal year. And there's worldwide support for Kate, the Princess of Wales, after she announced Friday she is receiving treatment for cancer. No jackpot winner in last night's Mega Millions, bumping Tuesday's jackpot above $1 billion. Tonight's Powerball worth an estimated $750 million. This is ABC News. Two people are dead after a multi-vehicle crash involving a school bus and concrete truck outside of Austin, Texas.
It was a school bus full of mainly children in pre-kindergarten on a field trip to a zoo. Just before 2 p.m., it was hit by a concrete truck coming from the other direction. Kevin Parker is division chief for Austin Travis County EMS.
I can tell you that we evaluated 53 total patients. Two of them, as we spoke of, were deceased.
A little boy on the bus died, as did an adult man in a vehicle behind the bus that was also involved. Alex Stone, ABC News.
The owner of the NBA's Washington Wizards and the NHL's Washington Capitals wants to build a $2 billion arena in Alexandria, Virginia, and move the teams out of D.C. But the D.C. Attorney General says the lease requires the teams to play their games in the downtown of the city through 2047. Meanwhile, the planned new arena stalled in the Virginia legislature. Brian Clark, ABC News.
Nightline with Pete Schwabba.
Sam Neill talked about being at the Jurassic Park premiere in London with his 10-year-old son and sitting next to Princess Diana. Apparently, Sam Neill's son had really bad gas through the whole premiere. His biggest fear was that Princess Di thought it was him, and he didn't say anything. He did not out his son. I think that's so cool.
That's a great dad right there.
That's a great dad.
Nightline with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights 7 till 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You know, I hope this is the best hour of your life. I'll tell you that. The Kripescast, folks.
My conversation with Taylor Kalmus, a.k.a. Dude Dad.
When you go to the movies and you get to the last climactic scene, you're not just like, oh, you know what would be fun? Let's leave. Let's finish this movie in the parking lot. You guys don't know what I'm talking about, do you?
I think he's talking about...
Let's pull out of this movie theater.
Kripescast every Saturday and Sunday at noon across Civic Media and on the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. More young Americans are getting colorectal cancer. Doctors are urging people to get screened earlier. Eric Tegedoff reports.
March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. Colorectal cancer is the third most common form of cancer and the second most lethal form in the world. Dr. Margaret Chen with Kaiser Permanente says the number of younger Americans with advanced stages of colorectal cancer has gone up in recent decades, prompting the U.S. Preventive Service Task Force to lower its recommended screening age from 50 to 45.
This is surprising to a lot of us, but the statistics have shown this change from what we used to think is a disease for older people to now a disease for younger people.
Chin says the proportion of cases for people under 55 has nearly doubled over the last 25 years. However, she also notes the total number of colorectal cancer cases has actually declined, and that's likely due to better detection. Chin says there are options for how people can get screened. The traditional method is by colonoscopy, but a newer method is the FitKit test, which can be used at home. Chin says it's important to find the option that works best for each person.
The best screening test is the one that you will do. So I just want to encourage people that we cannot find cancer if we're not looking for it. So please talk to your provider about getting screened as soon as you can.
Colonoscopies are typically done every 10 years, while the FIT tests are taken every year. With FIT kits, doctors look for microscopic blood and stool samples. I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Monday morning on Up North News Radio, our friends at Motherhood for Good on the importance of voting in your local school board races and right-wing takeover attempts.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Today, sunshine, 35. For tonight, chance of snow, lows around 25. Snow could be heavy on Sunday, and winds will pick up 30 to 35 miles per hour. 6 to 12 inches of snow is possible by Sunday night. Changes over to all rain by Monday.
It's 18 at our studios.
From the Mississippi to the Apple and points eastward, you're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK, Amory's radio station. Good morning, and welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning. It is Saturday, March 23rd, 2024. This is the second hour of our newly constituted, our newly restyled, our newly imagined Saturday morning broadcast, but staying with you on all those major issues in the area of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice in America and around the globe. Delighted to have you with me once again. I'm here in the studios of WAUK, the Civic Media Studios here in downtown Waukesha, with my wonderful producer, Anya. And together we're presenting to you once again, as we have done in the 89 previous broadcasts, information, insight, in our role as Amicus, thus the name of the show, Amicus, a Law Review. Amicus, as I said in great detail at the start of the first hour, this notion coming from the legal Latin and the fundamental notion there that an amicus is someone who's a friend of the court who provides and offers to the court some information, some expertise, some insight that may not otherwise be readily apparent to the court, to the litigants, to the parties to the case. But nonetheless, it's important to understanding and appreciating civics, understanding the law, understanding the facts, understanding what is going on in our world. And so most appropriate that we here at Civic Media would adopt that as our new moniker, our new name for this Saturday morning broadcast, much the same content. And as always, spending a lot of that talking about courts and the roles that they play in our lives. Delighted to have you with me once again this morning and every Saturday morning on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. As we concluded our first hour on this Saturday morning broadcast, we're talking about this major case before the Supreme Court on Monday of this past week called Murthy versus Missouri, M-U-R-T-H-Y, an oral argument, again, not a decision yet, an oral argument before the Supreme Court brought by the state of Missouri and the state of Louisiana, challenging decisions and actions undertaken by the Biden administration, reaching out to social media platform providers, asking them to take down, for example, information, misinformation about the elections, and indicating that the 2020 election may have been stolen. It was a product of fraud. Also encouraging those social media platform providers to prevent the postings and take down information suggesting that the coronavirus is in fact susceptible to remedies through untested and frankly dangerous medicinal applications, suggesting also that vaccines would not be significant in reducing your exposure. All those kinds of things, a part of the administration's effort to reach out and successfully reach out to these platform providers and say, you know what, that's not accurate. That is misleading. Take this down. It is not in the best interests of America and frankly can be just downright dangerous, including to young people. And of course, along the way, what happened is the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, again, hearing these cases from the two states, initially determines that indeed the administration has gone too far and finds, of course, during the course of their own deliberation, that the officials from the Biden administration had become much too excessively entangled with the platforms and the staff there, or use threats to spur them to act. The panel of the Fifth Circuit entered an injunction, basically stopping, forbidding these officials from, as they said, coercing or significantly encouraging social media companies to remove content protected by the First Amendment. The case comes up from the Fifth Circuit. Among those cases we described before, among the 10 right now pending before the Supreme Court, plainly gets some sympathetic hearing from the voices of folks like Justice Alito, Justice Gorsuch, and also others on the bench, including Clarence Thomas. But we also get some very interesting exchanges between other members of the Supreme Court, suggesting that there's nothing wrong with what the administration did. We've got Justice Kavanaugh, for example. He served in the White House, as you know, for the administration of George W. Bush. He said it was probably not uncommon for government officials to protest an upcoming story on surveillance or detention policy and say, you know, if you run that, it's going to harm the war effort and puts Americans at risk. Plainly, thinking back to his own time before he was a Supreme Court justice to the time that he was a lawyer in the President George Bush administration. That was perfectly proper, Kavanaugh says, adding it would be a different matter if the requests were backed by a threat of some certain kind of action, including some antitrust action, okay? Justice Kavanaugh said he understood, based upon earlier government service, that there are experienced government press people throughout the federal government who regularly call up the media and berate them. And Justice Kagan echoed that very point. She said this. She said, like Justice Kavanaugh, I've had some experience encouraging the press to suppress their own speech. She sketched out some of those specific conversations again from her time in the administration in the executive branch. She said, you just wrote a bad editorial. Here are five reasons you shouldn't write another one. You just write a story that's filled with factual errors. Here are the 10 reasons why you shouldn't do that again. Again, reciting, probably recalling perhaps her own engagement with the media when she was doing exactly what is being challenged here in this case. She wanted to say this. She said, I mean, this happens literally thousands of times a day in the federal government. And again, in the category of some jocularity, Chief Justice John Roberts, another former White House lawyer on the Supreme Court today, registered kind of a lighthearted dissent to laughter in the courtroom. He said this, I have no experience coercing anybody, he said. I want to make that clear. But he also goes on to add, the government is not monolithic and that different parts of it may hold and press competing views. Again, Justice Alito, who, as you well know, been the subject of a lot of critical news coverage, kind of joined in this somewhat lighthearted exchange, kind of taken up with the idea of pushing back against this. He's wondering out loud whether the court's public information officer was in the courtroom during the course of this particular oral argument. He said this, maybe she, then making reference again to the public information officer, should take a note about this, he said. So whenever they write something that we or I don't like, she can call them up and curse them out and say, why don't we be partners? We're on the same team. So a little bit of lightheartedness in the midst of this very serious discussion appears from the majority, not everybody in the Supreme Court, that in this case was called Murphy versus Missouri, the Supreme Court's going to overturn the Fifth Circuit and permit this administration and presumably future administrations, executive branch officials to engage in this kind of conversation with social media providers, other tech companies, even news organizations, using the language that Elena Kagan described here, that she used apparently, that Justice Kavanaugh used when he was in the White House, all those kinds of things to say, hey, knock it off, take this down, as long as there's nothing coercive about it, as long as you're not threatening things like legal action, threatening other conduct that could affect the very operation of that entity. As long as there's no coercion, it appears that that's going to be the linchpin for the Supreme Court in making this decision. Once again, Murphy versus Missouri, among these major social media cases, it has taken up this year, defining the relationship between government and social media, the things that we see all the time on social media platforms. Murphy versus Missouri. We'll look forward to reporting on that to you and commenting on it. You can determine whether or not my prediction about the likely result here is true or not when that decision comes out again, presumably May or June, maybe even July, as the Supreme Court addresses all of these cases. On the same day that it took up Murphy versus Missouri, the Supreme Court took up another case called NRA versus Vullo, V-U-L-L-O, another social media case, also among the 62 cases before the Supreme Court. What is this case all about? The National Rifle Association, the NRA, had argued that a New York official violated the First Amendment by encouraging some entities with whom she had a professional relationship in her role as a regulator to break ties with the NRA after the Parkland mass shooting in Florida. Now, what do we know about what happened here? What tea leaves can we read from this related but different case oral argument also happening on Monday? Again, some references made back and forth between the two cases, even though they involve different issues and different parties. A majority of the Supreme Court on Monday appeared to embrace arguments by the National Rifle Association that this New York State official had in fact violated the First Amendment by trying to dissuade some of these companies from doing business with it after that deadly school shooting in South Florida. The dispute, of course, began after a gunman, as we all recall with horror. 2018, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, Parkland, Florida. One of two cases on Monday, the other one, of course, being this Murphy versus Missouri case that involved government advocacy crossing the line or not crossing the line involving the protections of free speech. After the shooting, of course, we recall this well, catastrophically killing 17 students and staff members. This particular New York official, her name is Maria Vullo, V-U-L-L-O. She was then a superintendent of the New York State Department of Financial Services. She said that banks and other insurance companies regulated by her agency should assess whether they wanted to continue providing services to the NRA. She reached out to them and made that encouragement, if you will. The gun rights group sued, of course, accusing Vullo of unlawfully leveraging her authority as a government official, trying to do something that her authority did not permit her to do. It was a campaign by the state's highest political officials to use their power to coerce a boycott of a political advocacy organization because they disagreed with its advocacy. That was the statement argued and presented by the legal director for the ACLU, who's arguing on behalf of the NRA during the course of the oral argument. He added the officials' actions had cost the group millions of dollars. The lawyer for the New York officials, again, his name is Neil Katyal. You may see him on the news a lot. He was also a former acting solicitor general, the person who previously would present the government's positions before the Supreme Court. He pushed back on that. He said that state officials were simply performing their ordinary duties. We think, he said, that it was an exercise of legitimate law enforcement authority. And the solicitor general herself, Elizabeth Preligar, who's in a friend of the court brief, an amicus brief that she had filed with the Supreme Court, describes some of the NRA's claims as plausible, namely that Vullo may have crossed the constitutional line by coercing regulated entities to terminate their business relationships. When we come back, we're going to talk more about how the members of the Supreme Court responded to those oral arguments before it, in this case, NRA versus Vullo. Stay with us for that exposition.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Matinee on Air.
Most of us can agree the decision to have an abortion should be between a person and their doctor. Politicians should have no say at all. Thankfully, Senator Tammy Baldwin is standing up for our rights and working to keep politicians out of our medical decisions. After Roe v. Wade, the court case that protected abortion rights was overturned. Tammy Baldwin introduced the Women's Health Protection Act, which would ensure access to abortion abortion everywhere in the United States, including here in Wisconsin. The bill would end extreme abortion bans that have no exceptions for rape, incest, or the life of the mother, and threaten doctors with criminal charges for providing abortion care. Senator Baldwin also introduced legislation that would protect the right to travel across state lines for reproductive health care and safeguard access to contraception. Call Senator Tammy Baldwin at 202-224-5653. Tell her thank you for fighting back against extreme abortion bans. Paid for by A Better Wisconsin Together, Inc.
This is Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK.
We are back this, our Saturday morning broadcast, talking with you this morning about these significant oral arguments happening just this past week, early in the day on Monday, talking about social media, responses by our Supreme Court justices to the interaction between social media and government and platform providers. What can we understand about the First Amendment? This case, NRA versus VULO, National Rifle Association, arguing that this New York State official had crossed the line, had violated the First Amendment by encouraging entities that she was regulating to break ties with the group based upon their advocacy. Arguments before the Supreme Court on Monday. During that oral argument, an assistant to the Solicitor General drew a distinction between this NRA case and the other case we talked about, this Murphy versus Missouri case, heard earlier that day. And that, of course, by the states to try to curb the Biden administration, from its efforts to crack down on what it viewed as misinformation in social media. The Murphy versus Missouri case, and again, describing the differences between that case and this one. Like the Murphy case, the NRA argument centered on the line between coercion and persuasion by government officials. It seems to be where the Supreme Court in these two cases is coming down. Out-and-out coercion, obviously not appropriate. Persuasion may be so. And where to draw that line appeared to be front and centered for most, if not all, of the Supreme Court justices. The Supreme Court Chief Justice says this: there's considerable overlap, obviously, he said, with the first case, again, making reference to Murphy, even during the course of the oral argument on the VULO case. Could you articulate, he said to the attorneys appearing before him, what the significant differences are between your position in this case and the office's position, that is the Office of the Solicitor General here, in the prior case? And the Solicitor General said, there are no differences as to legal principles. Basically saying, Justice, we are consistent in our view. The difference here is that there is a specific coercive threat in this particular case that did not exist in the Murphy case. And that seems to be where most of the justices are coming down in deciding this case. He was referring, of course, to this allegation the NRA had made that VULO had met privately with the organization's insurance partners, demanded that one of them, Lloyd's of London, stop providing insurance to gun groups, especially the NRA. And the attorney had argued that an urge to the justices that to hinge the First Amendment analysis on the nature, the focus of that meeting, it's just a straightforward way of resolving this case, the attorney advocated. In other words, if you make this very fact-specific and find that this particular engagement by VULO, coercive in nature, encouraging them, more than encouraging them, not to engage with the NRA, that's the line that you can draw. You can draw a specific rule of operation here that permits engagement but not coercion. That's how the attorneys seem to be encouraging the Supreme Court to decide in the end. And after Brett Kavanaugh repeated to the attorney for New York that he understood the government to be arguing that the meeting itself is enough for a First Amendment violation, that attorney pushed back, contending that the New York officials were engaged in normal plea bargaining, and said this: if that meeting is enough, Justice Kavanaugh, every meeting, every plea negotiation is enough. That's literally what they are. They're done in secret behind a closed door, to use their insidious language. That's the natural give and take. Again, this is the lawyer for New York arguing that this is the normal practice. This is what has got to happen here. The NRA, of course, objecting that, citing what it described as VULO's enormous regulatory power, adding that she'd applied pressure tactics, including back-channel threats omnibus guidance letters, selective enforcement of regulatory infractions. The organization warned of the wide-ranging consequences of a ruling, things the Supreme Court's always concerned about. If we announce today a rule, how does this affect the next case down the road, the next social media case that we may hear in a future term, making similar pleas about other hot-button issues like abortion and the environment and commerce and education, all those other things out there down the road. All of this pending before the Supreme Court now. It appears the Supreme Court not dividing in this resolution of these two cases, but probably finding a First Amendment violation based upon coercion in the Vullo case, but not a First Amendment violation in Murthy based upon persuasion and encouragement and drawing that articulated legal line between the two of them. Fascinating stuff to think about as we consider the role once again of government and the law and social media providers and where those lines are drawn. We know as well that there are still those other cases out there, we've talked about them before, in which a couple of states have also sought restrictions by the social media platform providers themselves when it comes to their uniformly taking down on their own initiative postings that are offensive, that are conveying misinformation, that are otherwise contrary to the best interests of the public. Laws out there passed by some state legislatures that prohibit the providers from taking those down. Highly unlikely in that particular case, as we have talked before, Supreme Court's going to embrace the legitimacy of those state laws that restrict that kind of activity by the providers, which in the end are private companies. Lots and lots of things to digest here. Lots and lots of things to consume as the Supreme Court tells us more and more, probably in May, in June, maybe in July, about once again this relationship between social media and government and you and me. No discussion, of course, of the Supreme Court could not be included, could not be complete without including references to other things also going on in the terms of oral arguments. Just this past Tuesday, Supreme Court heard oral argument in a case involving expert testimony in a drug courier prosecution called Diaz versus United States. Another case called Truck Insurance versus Kaiser Gypsum, a Chapter 11 bankruptcy proceeding, giving you some sense about the diversity of the cases, those 62 cases pending before the Supreme Court. On Wednesday this past week, in a case called Gonzalez versus Trevino, a case involving probable cause and retaliatory arrest claims in that case. Another case also argued on Wednesday, Texas versus New Mexico and Colorado. This has to do with the Rio Grande Compact and the decisions of a special master. Lots and lots of things before the Supreme Court also be decided in May, June, and maybe even in July. Also significant to note, of course, that there are five oral arguments coming up this coming week as well, including FDA versus Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine. What is that? That's that major mifepristone case coming out of the Northern District of Texas, in which the federal district court judge affirmed basically, not completely, but affirmed by the Fifth Circuit, prohibiting access to mifepristone as a part of reproductive services, determining that the decision of the FDA to authorize the use of mifepristone as a safe and secure drug was arbitrary and capricious. That among the cases Supreme Court also has before it having to do with our agencies and administrative functions. That argument coming up this coming week, March 26, major case. Once again, you can hear the oral argument on the mifepristone case, that coming up just this week. And departing briefly from the Supreme Court, of course, on Monday, the day before the mifepristone case, Judge Juan Merchan entertaining argument from attorneys in the prosecution in Manhattan. When we come back, I'm going to tell you more about that and then get back to more Supreme Court information for your information and also your guidance coming up this coming week.
The St. Croix Valley. We're in touch with you. You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK, Amory's radio station.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Russian authorities say at least 133 people are dead after Friday's attack on a concert hall in Moscow. ABC's Patrick Reville has the latest.
President Vladimir Putin has said Russia has detained all four of the suspected gunmen from the concert hall attack, as well as seven alleged accomplices. Putin said the men were arrested while trying to flee to Ukraine. ISIS has claimed responsibility, and the US says it shared intelligence with Moscow just weeks ago that the group was planning similar attacks.
President Biden today is expected to sign the $1.2 trillion government funding bill the Senate passed early this morning. It provides funding for the rest of the fiscal year. And there's worldwide support for Kate, the Princess of Wales, after she announced Friday she is receiving treatment for cancer. Now, jackpot winner in last night's Mega Millions, bumping Tuesday's jackpot above $1 billion. Tonight's Powerball worth an estimated $750 million. This is ABC News.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
Wisconsin goes one and done. I'm Mike Clemens with sports. March Madness, the Wisconsin Badgers eliminated from the NCAA tournament. Too many missed shots, too many turnovers. They lose to James Madison University, 72-61. The Badgers season over with a record of 22-14. Marquette with a win over Western Kentucky, 87-69. They'll face Colorado on Sunday. Golden Eagles head coach Shaka Smart.
I thought Western Kentucky played with phenomenal aggressiveness in the first half. Hats off to their team, the way that they competed and battled. Fortunately, Tyler and Cam kept us afloat. You know, we were fortunate to only be down 7 at the half. So just grateful for the response. You know, we talk about building championship habits. One of the most important of those is the way we respond to adversity. And the guys did a great job of that today.
Hockey, the Wisconsin Badgers women's team beat Colgate 3-1. They'll advance to the finals against Ohio State on Sunday. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Today, sunshine, 35. For tonight, chance of snow, lows around 25. Snow could be heavy on Sunday, and winds will pick up 30 to 35 miles per hour. 6 to 12 inches of snow is possible by Sunday night. Changes over to all rain by Monday.
It's 21 right now.
Matt Nair on air.
The hearing surrounding the alleged Biden crime family didn't go very well for House Republicans. They got nothing.
They also have no way of moving this country forward. Every 45 days, we're on the brink of a shutdown because these idiots can't come together and put forth a budget. How about this? You don't get to try to impeach anybody until you finish your homework.
I would heartily back that.
Matt Nair on air. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Being blind doesn't always look how others may think.
Retinitis pigmentosa aimed to overwhelm my family.
It tried to cut me down.
I know where to find support and where I can be seen.
Innovative research, educational resources, supportive community. The Foundation Fighting Blindness is leading the charge in finding treatments and cures for blinding diseases. Learn more at fightingblindness.org. A public service message from the Foundation Fighting Blindness.
The Todd Alba Show.
Our ride into spring continues. We have some great prizes to give away. A weekend getaway at Chula Vista Resort, a bike, and a three-way blender.
A three-in-one blender.
Oh, three-in-one. So I misread that. We're having our own political threesome
Todd
here.
Todd Alba going with the After Dark Show all of a sudden.
It's always a pleasure.
This is Civic Media, not Cinemax, Todd.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
You are listening to your local Civic Media radio station on air. Thank you. Did you know we are always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app too? And if you miss a show or game, find it wherever you get your podcasts or on our website, civicmedia.us.
Connecting with you on air, online, and on the Civic Media app. This is Lake Air 1260 AM, WLAK, Amory's radio station.
Welcome back to Amicus, the Law Review. This morning, talking, as we often do here in our Saturday morning broadcast, all about the United States Supreme Court, talking about these major oral arguments of justice past week, having to do with social media. The Supreme Court probably making decisions in the end premised upon the nature of the government interaction with social media providers. If it is coercive, if it is threatening, not permissible under the First Amendment, but if it is simply encouraging, it's got some legitimate purpose, that probably permissible. We'll see what the Supreme Court says in these two cases, Murphy versus Missouri and NRA versus Vulo, coming up in the next several months. Also talking about what's happening next week. Lots of things going on in the area of rule of law and justice in our nation's courts. On Tuesday, March 26th, that same Supreme Court going to be hearing this case involving mifepristone. This is the FDA case coming out of Judge Kaczmarek's decision. Northern Texas finding that the FDA had improperly authorized the use of mifepristone for reproductive services, for abortion procedures, up to the Fifth Circuit, now on to the Supreme Court. That argument, again, this coming up this coming Tuesday, along with four others of the among the 62 cases pending before the Supreme Court. The day before, as I was reporting, as we were calendaring right before the break, on March 25th, not in the Supreme Court, but in a trial court in Manhattan. Proceedings not in the nature of a trial, but the judge. This is the judge, Juan Merchan, who's presiding over the case involving Donald Trump, brought by the DA, his name is Alvin Bragg, against Donald Trump, alleging that he violated New York law in providing hush monies, catch and kill monies, in connection with an attempt to silence at least one porn star and coming forward with an affair, a story of an affair that she had with Donald Trump right prior to the 2016 election. All of that, one of the several trials, criminal trials pending against Donald Trump right now. The one that probably still has the most likelihood of perhaps going to trial. We recall well that it was supposed to go to trial this coming Monday, March 25th, all anticipating the first time in our nation's history that a former president would be on trial, jury selection, a jury hearing evidence of criminal conduct in a criminal court in our nation against a former president. Did not happen. Why? Because a little over a week or so ago, it turns out that the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York, the Department of Justice, produced about 100,000 documents, additional documents, not previously a part of discovery, the production of materials to all the parties, including especially defense in this case. And as a result of that, Alvin Bragg saying, you know what? Under the rules, under the regulations, under fundamental justice, it is only right that Donald Trump and his attorneys get the opportunity to review all of this material we have not previously provided. And so Judge Merchan obliged under the law to postpone the trial beginning on Monday, but instead deciding to call everybody in. And he's going to do that on Monday morning, a very interesting, fascinating hearing, perhaps going to be available also live, certainly will be recorded. And Judge Merchan asking the all-important question, what is going on here? He asked the parties already to present to him in writing some memorandums about who said what to whom, who produced what when, under what circumstances, what did the subpoenas say, past and recent, how did this production go? He wants timelines. He's gotten that from them. And now, come Monday morning, he is going to be quizzing all the attorneys, including Alvin Bragg, including counsel for the defendant, Donald Trump, on what happened here. Why is it that my trial, he will say, that I had scheduled here in my court for many, many months, has now got to be postponed at least for another month while we figure out what's happening with discovery? He is going to be asking lots and lots of questions about the conduct, the behavior of all the parties, including, I would offer, the U.S. Department of Justice in producing these materials to Alvin Bragg, to the defense, late in the game. We have known about this particular offense conduct for many years, shortly after the 2016 election, investigated by the Department of Justice. That's why they had these materials in the first place. Some of that material, highly relevant. Why? Because it involves Michael Cohen. Michael Cohen, who again was the former president's fixer, his private attorney, if you will. Michael Cohen also now testifying in connection with this pending case in front of Judge Merchan. Highly relevant.
Judge Merchan asking these questions and determining, presumably, in the end, what he's going to do. Hopefully getting this case back on track after he gets the explanations that he is going to be soliciting, asking the attorneys to come back. He has said at least as early as April 15th, maybe even later than that, maybe into May, maybe into June, depending upon what the merits of this are all about. Donald Trump's attorney will certainly be arguing for an extended period of time. It is 100,000 documents. It does take some time to review them. Maybe not all of them have to be read in document form. A lot of this can be done electronically using search engines. But nonetheless, appropriate to provide the defense some opportunity to review all that. What is the amount of time that needs to be taken to do that? What is the new trial date? We may have that. We may have that at the end of the day on Monday after the parties explain to Judge Merchan what it is that happened here. A big week next week coming up in the courts of America. We also know that something else significant happened this past week, not involving an ultimate case presented to the Supreme Court, but its administration of these continuing appeals having to do with immigration law. We know the Congress came fairly close not too long ago to passing a bipartisan omnibus immigration bill, fell apart, presumably upon the encouragement of presidential candidate Donald Trump, two Republicans inside the House of Representatives not to go ahead with it, to vote against the own bill, the bill that they themselves had put together, all of that pending in the area generally of immigration. At the same time, Texas had passed this major law that threatened and called into question the authority of the federal government under that thing called the United States Constitution, the federal government, the exclusive authority when it comes to immigration. The Texas law, which had empowered local officials, state officials, to arrest and deport migrants who enter the country, presumably through the Texas border, without authorization. All of that law, of course, and other aspects of it, challenged by the Biden administration in the federal court, saying you can't do that. That's contrary to the Constitution. Only the federal government, only federal agencies, only the executive branch is responsible for the administration of immigration law under our Constitution, cannot do this. Well, the Supreme Court on Tuesday temporarily sided with Texas in this increasingly bitter fight with the Biden administration over this immigration policy issue, allowing this very extensive law to go into effect that makes it a crime for migrants to enter Texas without authorization. And, of course, typical with when the court acts on what's called emergency applications. Again, these are not the major cases, not among the 62, but emergency applications to the court to do something, to stop a law, which we've talked about before. The court giving no specific reasons for doing that, but Justice Amy Coney Barrett, joined by Brett Kavanaugh, filed a concurring opinion that sort of seemed to express the majority's bottom line. They were turning the case to the appeals court, and yes, indeed, that's the Fifth Circuit, for a prompt ruling on whether the law should be paused while an appeal moves forward. Following all of that, Justice Barrett wrote, if a decision does not issue soon, the applicants may return to this court. All of this has to do with the interplay between things that lawyers once again love to talk about, the difference between an administrative stay and a stay pending appeal. Justice Sotomayor, joined by Justice Jackson and others, said the majority had rewarded the Court of Appeals in the Fifth Circuit for using this unseemly procedural gambit, is what she said. The appeals court had entered an administrative stay of a trial judge's ruling, effectively blocking the law and therefore compelling the majority in the Supreme Court to stop this law from going into effect. Well, that was chapter one on Tuesday, all that happening, that dissenting language coming out of some dissenters when it comes to this tension, if you will, between the stays, the administrative stay, and a stay pending appeal. Sure enough, the law goes temporarily into effect after that Supreme Court ruling. But hours later on Tuesday, that very appeals court that the Supreme Court made reference to unexpectedly issues an order effectively blocking the law's implementation, sending it back to where it was before. The state of Texas, again, late Tuesday, once again prevented from enforcing this strict new immigration law that gives these local police agencies the power, incredible power, to arrest migrants who cross the border without authorization. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals once again, before midnight on that day, taps a day of legal whiplash, some whiplash having to do that day, hours after the Supreme Court again allows the law to go into effect. The law, needless to say, and the ruling on this back and forth creating a certain amount of confusion among the border, including law enforcement, outraging some immigration advocates, tending to show once again the problems in administration of immigration law when you don't have an omnibus bill in place. At issue, of course, is whether the law should be put on a long-term hold while the Biden administration claimed that the law is unconstitutional, makes its way through the legal system. The Fifth Circuit held that oral argument on Wednesday after this whipsaw engagement on Tuesday on whether the district court's injunction, the district court stopping this matter, that injunction should remain in place as the appeals court process goes forward. A lot to consume there. This is not intuitive. There's a lot going on here. Not clear what further action the court might take. But for the moment anyway, the law is again blocked. And consequences to that as well, as we know in the wake of that. Recall well the Supreme Court's decision on Tuesday, the follow-up on with the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals also later that day, the Fifth Circuit hearing on Wednesday, allowing Texas on this law to first arrest and deport migrants and then for prohibiting them from doing just that, has residents back to the situation in Arizona from about a decade ago when, you may recall, the state of Arizona, the legislature there passed its own law as a sort of crackdown against illegal immigration more than a decade ago. The Arizona effort, you may remember, became known as the Show Me Your Papers law, passed by the Arizona legislature, set off an equal torrent, if you will, of anger, fear among not only migrants but also advocates, jolted the state's political status in ways that are still reverberating. Supreme Court in that case saying, no, only the United States government. It's a federal matter. James Madison wrote about this in the Constitution. Arizona can't do that. Maybe offering a lesson to what the Supreme Court should do in its ultimate disposition of this case in Texas. Along the way, some other implications from the lack of certainty, this back and forth, this whipsaw in Texas. We know that on Tuesday, Iowa lawmakers passed a law that would make it a crime to enter the state after being deported or denied entry into the United States of America. They're taking on, once again, their own legislation. And that passage, of course, puts this Midwestern state on track to join Texas doing the same thing, enforcing immigration, which, again, is exclusively inside the federal authority. Mexico, of course, which is supposed to be the recipient of any of these recently deported migrants coming out of the state of Texas. The law in Texas, this state law, says we're going to return them to Mexico regardless of their state of origin. Mexico says, nope, we're not accepting any deportations made by Texas under any circumstances. The country's foreign ministry said on Tuesday, in response to all of this going on, they condemned the state law known as Senate Bill 4, saying it would separate families, violate the human rights of migrants, and generate what Mexico called hostile environments for more than 10 million people of Mexican origin living in Texas. Plainly, Mexico is saying, we're not playing along with this law right now, stayed there in the state of Texas. Again, hearings coming up in the state of Texas, the Fifth Circuit going to decide ultimately, probably back to the Supreme Court, question whether it'll be this term or in a future term. Shades also of what the Supreme Court did in the Dobbs decision. The Dobbs decision, again, permitting a law there to go into effect on abortion even before deciding the Dobbs case. All of that coming out of federal appeals courts, the United States Supreme Court just this past week. More on all of this and the actions of our federal courts and state courts right after this break.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Up North News Radio.
The Todd Alba Show.
I love me some Drew Holiday. My favorite buck. I love what he's doing. I just really, really wish it wasn't for the Boston Celtics. My loyalty is still more to Giannis. But, like, when Drew scores a bucket still, I'm like, yeah.
That's like to a former
Drew.
Lover.
I got a Drew Holiday jersey, a Bucks jersey, and I got an Aaron Jones Packers jersey. This is so why... I'm a scoring former lover for both of those players.
The Todd Alba Show, weekdays noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. The Maggie Dawn Show.
How to avoid this apocalyptic nightmare? It's to vote. Because at the end of the day, the only thing that will save our democracy is our democracy. America, make your voice heard. Turn away from authoritarianism and vote this November.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK. Welcome to Amicus, a law review. Good morning. And welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel.
And we are back, and this is Amicus, a law review. This is our newly restyled, our reinvigorated, and our reimagined program here. As always, talking with you about law, justice, government, and the aspiration for justice in America, in our state of Wisconsin, and throughout the world. As a part of this, in this, our final segment, a couple of comments about something else that follows up on a story that we did in great detail, some microscopic justice of just last week. You may recall well that we spent a lot of time parsing through this major opinion issued by Judge Scott McAfee. He is the state court judge in Fulton County, Georgia. He's presiding over that omnibus RICO case in which Donald Trump and many others are charged with RICO violations, again, for attempting to undermine the voting process, the electoral process there in Georgia. The court entertaining during the course of 2.5 days of evidentiary hearings this petition by at least one of the defendants, joined in by 7 or 8 others, including Donald Trump, seeking to have Fannie Willis, who's the DA in that case, disqualified based upon her personal relationship with a fellow named Nathan Wade, who is the lead prosecutor. These hearings, fairly salacious, talking about personal relationships, financial relationships between them. And in the end, Scott McAfee issuing this major decision the week before this past one, finding that there's no conflict of interest, that Fannie Willis does not have to be taken off the case, but that there is an appearance of impropriety such that her lead prosecutor, Nathan Wade, needs to go. And that's indeed what he did shortly after the order was issued. Now, as I said in the previous broadcast, Fannie Willis has 3 alternatives in the wake of all of that. She can do nothing. She can, in fact, go ahead and prosecute the case. And that is certainly what she will do. She also has this case from earlier in the week in which the judge got rid of a couple of some 4 different counts in the indictment itself. And she can decide whether to go back to the grand jury and seek to reindict those counts, or she can appeal that as well. But on the issue of whether or not she could be disqualified, she can now go ahead and prosecute this case, as can her office. And so the significant event that happened this past week, based upon the expressed interest of Donald Trump and others, including the particular petitioner on the disqualification motion, to appeal that decision by Judge McAfee, finding that she did not have to be disqualified, finding that there was, in fact, not a conflict of interest, expressing interest in appealing that, what does Judge McAfee do? What has he done as a part of his supervision of this case? He issued something called a Certificate of Appealability. And that certificate, again, an entry of an order by the judge there, permits the Trump defendants to take an immediate appeal of his order that permits Fannie Willis to stay in the case. And so that will almost certainly go up on appeal. The Georgia Court of Appeals, of course, has to agree. They have to grant, if you will, their own writ of certiorari to hear the case. But the judge basically is saying, yes, I'll permit you to go ahead and appeal my decision, finding that there is no conflict of interest here. This process could take weeks. The actual appeal, of course, could take months at a minimum.
And so what it appears is that while this case is going up in appeal, even so, Judge McAfee not going to be staying his own conduct of this trial. It looks as though, at least for now, he's going to continue to handle the proceedings in this case and move it forward, although he has not yet set a trial date. And so we've got all these things happening in Georgia. This case, of course, different from the presidential immunity appeal in the D.C. case, keeping all of this straight, which pauses the work in the trial court in that case while the Supreme Court issues, ultimately, its decision on immunity. That's the matter that's going to be argued before the Supreme Court in later next month, in the month of April. A couple of final things here as we begin to conclude our broadcast this morning. First of all, I want to make a programming note, and that is in the Maggie Dawn Show coming up this Friday, the 29th, I'm going to be serving as a guest host back here in the studios with my great producer, Anya, from 2 to 4. We're going to talk all about voting during the course of that program. 4 days before the election on April 2nd, I thank Maggie, the producer, Anya, and all the members of the staff of Civic Media for giving me that opportunity. Join us from 2 to 4 this coming Friday, the 29th. Beyond that, I want to say how much it has been a delight not only to work with all the staff of Civic Media, including Anya, all the other great producers, the staff, the executives of Civic Media, giving me this wonderful chance to come into your homes, your businesses, maybe your cars as well on Saturday mornings, and especially in recent times for recasting, restyling our program to see some more modest changes in the future. Our new show called Amicus, a Law Review, again, focusing upon the major news stories in government, law, and the aspiration for justice. We'll go out today to give you some sense of our continuing music change. This is Michael Gunlock. He styled this wonderful piece called Crazy Blues Jazz Piano Solo. It is the basis upon which we enter and we also leave today our program, Amicus, a Law Review. Come back and hear with us, be with us again next Saturday. Have a good week, everybody.
Like smelt fries and music on the river, we're uniquely Amory. This is Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK, Amory's radio station.
For the longest time, it was hard for me to even get out of the house, much less do a backside 180. It took me a bit to understand what was going on, but eventually I learned I had anxiety. Now I'm getting help for it and feeling so much better. Sure, some days are better than others, but the whole thing about getting out of the house, that's not really an issue anymore.
Mental health care is working. See what it can do for you at mentalhealthcareworks.org. A message from the American Psychiatric Association Foundation.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us. You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK Amory and 107.5 FM W298 DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.